Good morning. So what I wanted to talk about this morning is mindfulness of breathing. Somehow I thought it'd be nice to go back to basics. And partly inspired by it, by the fact that I've been thinking a lot about my wife's breathing and that she's about to give birth. And so learning about different ways of breathing in the birthing process has been very much in my mind. And there's, you know, all kinds of breathing ways, deep breathing and panting and blowing and all kinds of things. And all in the service of helping with the birthing process. And you know, I've been attending to my breath now as a meditator for almost 30 years, and rather than the breath becoming less and less interesting in that process, you think after 30 years of watching your breath, it gets, you know, you kind of, you know, you've seen it all, you know. And what I find is that it continues to get more and more interesting over time. And because the breath seems so, for various reasons, one is the breath is so connected to so much else in life. It's continuous with the environment and continuous with the inner environment and all its different aspects. And also the breath is connected to a tremendous amount of sense of well-being as a meditator. And so I find it more and more interesting the more I do it, more captivating, more absorbing. And I remember when I was about 20, it was the first time I felt like I'd really learned how to breathe. I had, of course, had breathed my whole life, but I was living on a farm and for about 6 months, and we were living a very wholesome life and getting up early in the morning and going into the fields and getting the cows and milking them and, you know, mowing the grass and, you know, the whole thing of a dairy farm. And I was just absorbed in that world. There was no world outside for me as far as I could tell. Just I was living there day by day. And I remember feeling, sometimes walking across the fields to get the cows or whatever, I was surprised by my breathing. Being feeling so free, so relaxed, so kind of integral to my whole sense of being, that I hadn't had any experience of that before in my life, and I kind of told myself, oh, I've learned how to breathe, you know, I've learned how to free my breath in a beautiful way, and I'm reminded of Gurdjieff, the story about Gurdjieff going to one of his Sufi teachers in Pakistan, Afghanistan, or wherever he was, he went. Back then, it was not so easy to get there, probably more harder than it is now, and probably a big endeavor to find his way to these Sufi masters. And he finally found one, and the master asked him, why are you here? And Gurdjieff said, I'm here to learn how to breathe. And apparently the story goes, then the Sufi master went into peals of laughter, thought that was the funniest thing he'd heard, and then proceeded for the next number of years to teach Gurdjieff how to breathe. And so this thing about breathing that we often take for granted is something that can be cultivated or developed or enhanced, or we can develop a deeper appreciation of it as we go along. We don't have to take it for granted. I once somehow calculated that we breathe, I don't know anymore, this was many years ago, I don't know if it's accurate, I don't know how I got to the number, but we breathe 23,000 times a day. 23,000 times. And then I read somewhere that we consume, is that the right word, 4,500 gallons of air every day. That's quite something, huh? How much water, liquids do you drink every day? It's quite a bit less than that. Mm-hmm. And then how much food? And, you know, we often get so focused on food and drink and whatever. And we can go fine for a number of days without drinking and eating. But you can't go for many minutes without breathing. And we take it so much for granted. You know, it's this constant thing. This thing is so repetitive, so ingrained, an essential part of our life. And probably most of you are familiar with the idea that in most cultures, most religious cultures, The word for breath is very important in the tradition. In some traditions, it's almost synonymous with, or used, the word for breath is used for the word for spirit. The word spirit, just that itself, to respire, to breathe, to expire. The word spirit means in Greek, or Latin, I guess in Latin, also means to breathe. And so respire, inspire, expire. All these words with spire in them have the same connection to spirit. The word spiritual has the word breath in the word. And I'm fond of the fact that the idea of spiritual inspiration, both words have the word breath in it. Mm-hmm. It's so central in so many different traditions. And a beautiful thing, I don't know German, but who knows German here? Anybody? So the word atem, does that mean breath?
What word?
Atem, A-T-E-M. In German, what's the word for breath in German?
Atem.
Atem. So the way that the linguists explain this, the word Atem in German has the same Indo-European root as the word Atman does in Sanskrit, or Atta in Pali. And Atman, of course, is the in Sanskrit, in Indian, is the probably one of the better translations into English is soul, the soul that the Buddha, of course, in some way or other negated. But they get an idea that this close connection with the soul or the spirit and breath is seen in this kind of amazing way in which the German word for breath is connected to the Sanskrit word for soul. And so you can go through the list. There's all this, Hebrew and Greek and Latin and German and Chinese, and all these different languages have some word that for breath, which is also then has double meaning, meaning spirit or sometimes angel, messenger of God. Sometimes, in the Bible, we talk about breathe. God, we didn't come. Whoever it was that there back in the beginning, this guy or gal that God first infused with breath in order to make life happen. I've never been present for a birth before, so hopefully I'll see it now, any minute. Actually, I said I would turn the cell phone on for the talk. I don't think, so excuse me if it rings. There's only one thing it could ring for. that was not farm when I was 20. I was there for birth for a cow. And it was quite amazing to watch this calf being born. The way I experienced it is that the embryonic sac was intact. And so as the calf was coming out, the sac was kind of, or whatever, the skin, or whatever was covered the face of the calf, but it was transparent. So you can see the face through that sac. And so the head came out, and it didn't look like it was alive to me. The eyes were closed, it was sleeping, or it looked kind of inert in some ways. That's the way I experienced it. And then that sac burst, and these eyes opened, and the calf took a breath. And somehow the eyes opening, it was like this moment of kind of just life happening. Of course, it was alive before, but it seemed like it wasn't. Just why am I saying this? I lost track. Spirit. So we talk about it's kind of almost a cliche now about how we really our life begins when we take our first breath, and life will end when you take your last breath. Your last thought will probably be synonymous with taking your last breath. So breath is appreciated very deeply by different religious cultures. And can you hear me? Any time you have trouble hearing me, raise your hand. And so we know, because sometimes when I'm saying things, my voice drops. And then I've heard that people have hard time hearing in the background. But let me know. So... So in the Buddhist tradition also, the breath is very central. And I think virtually every Buddhist tradition I know about emphasizes the breath. And just coming in here this morning, I went through the library and I just looked at the, somehow I glanced at the shelves of the bookcase there. And there was a book that was turned out. You know, most books are kind of, you see, you only see the spine. But there's one book that was kind of pointed outwards. And so I hadn't seen before, I just don't notice the title. And since I was giving this talk, it was a nice coincidence. It was called Dakini's Warm Breath, The Feminine Principle in Tibetan Buddhism. And Dakini is a sky dancer. It's kind of like the, here in the Jhaka they describe it as the semi-wrathful spirit woman who manifests in visions, dreams, and meditation experiences. So the author, Judith Simir Brown, writes the last paragraph of the book. So I was looking, you know, to see if I could find something. The warm breath of the Dakinis is said to be present when the wisdom mind of the practitioner, steeped in devotion, meets the blessings of the lineage of realized ones in the transmission of the oral instructions for meditation. The warm breath of the Dakinis is present when the wisdom mind of the practitioner, steeped in devotion, meets the blessings of the lineage of realized ones. What a great sentence. So the wisdom mind of the practitioner, that's you. Your wisdom mind is present. Steeped in devotion. So some idea that being with yourself, being with practice, being with your breath is a devotional act. It's a faith act. Something that, I like the word heartfelt. It's a heartfelt activity. And it meets the blessings of the lineage of those enlightened ones. So, you know, in some religions, including Buddhism, we go on pilgrimage. You know, the Christians go to Jerusalem and you do the different stages of Christ. Now, they made more stages recently. So, you can, you know, it's a longer trip. But I've been to Jerusalem and you can kind of walk down the streets there. And it's kind of very interesting to see. You stop at different places that are important in the life of Jesus. And it's kind of, I imagine for Christians, very powerful to kind of actually feel like you're in the place where these things happen that you read about or heard about for years. And for Buddhists, it's to go to India and go, you know, pilgrimage to Bodh Gaya and different places where the Buddha actually lived. And I did a little bit of that once where I went to the hot season to Bodh Gaya, so there was no tourists there. No one was there hardly. And we had the whole Bodhi temple to ourselves almost. And so and they didn't have a fence around the Bodhi tree then. So I went and meditated underneath the Bodhi tree, which is supposed to be the spot and the tree under which the Buddha meditated. And it was quite powerful for me to kind of be all the associations I have with that spot. So, but there's another kind of pilgrimage, which I'm fond of thinking about, and that is connecting with the breath. The Buddha talked about practicing breath meditation even after he was enlightened. It was a very common practice that the Buddha did for himself. And his breathing is basically similar to our breath. I mean, it's not like he's just a strange, you know, guy from Mars who had a different kind of breathing. When we connect with our breath, we're connecting to the same kind of activity that the Buddha spent a lot of his time paying attention to. So it's a kind of pilgrimage. It's kind of like I feel in some ways that when I connect to my breath, I connect to the same reality that the Buddha was connecting to. And that feels like kind of a pilgrimage. It's kind of great. You kind of little sense of kind of being in the same realm or dimension as the Buddha. In the same way, someone would go on pilgrimage to a site and feel somehow that they're partaking or sharing or being connected to something of historical spiritual importance. This warm breath. Isn't that a great expression, the warm breath? It's very comforting to me. Though maybe not in India where it was so hot. They talk about cool. Here, you know, Ajahn Amaro likes to say that in English-inspired countries, the idea of warmth, you know, being warm-hearted and all that is a very powerful metaphor. But in India, where it's so hot, they use cool as a very important metaphor. So we have to remember that. So the idea in Thailand, they use the word nibbana. They translate it as being cool. But be cool. And it doesn't quite mean the same meaning as we say in English. But you get cooled out through practice. And most of us don't want to be cooled out, you know, through practice. It's kind of not, the connotations are not so good unless we're on fire with anger. But because of the hot culture, being cool is being refreshed. And because of the cold, English, damp weather, being warm, you know, is maybe has more meaning for English-speaking people. This warm breath remains in the practice of meditation, providing support and nourishment for the meditator. The warm breath is also a protection, guarding the motivation of the meditator as well as the authenticity of the teachings. Isn't that great? So it's a protection, guarding your motivation. The breath somehow or other protects or guards your motivation in practice, as well as the authenticity of the teachings. So where do we find the authenticity, the authority, the validity of the teachings? And here she says, you know, you find it in your own breath. That's where you can find it. It protects it. When we understand the image of the Dakini's warm breath, we discover the key to her centrality in the tantric traditions in which the Dakini symbolizes the spiritual subjectivity of the practitioner, the fruits of meditation experienced in a constantly fresh, immediate way as the dynamic display of wisdom. The fruits of meditation experienced in a constantly fresh, immediate way as the dynamic display of wisdom. So, I can think of three different, there's many functions of mindfulness of breathing, and Judith Zimmer Brown talks about some of them. But I'd like to kind of talk about three different benefits or functions of the breath, breath meditation. One is that it's a, by connecting with our breathing, by hanging in there with our breath and staying with one breath after the other, it can be a very powerful way of leaving ourselves alone. And one of the great blessings and benefits of meditation practice comes from its ability to help us leave ourselves alone. In contrast to the way we are often in life, when we're not, we don't leave ourselves alone. We often judge ourselves or try to change ourselves or criticizing ourselves or demanding things of ourselves or measuring ourselves or, you know, there's all this activity. We're pushing ourselves forward, trying to make something happen, whipping ourselves, holding ourselves back, being afraid. We do all this stuff with who we are. And doing nothing with who we are is somewhat unusual. And for me personally, one of the more powerful places where I can learn to leave myself alone is in meditation practice. And it's a, leaving myself alone means very much just that. It means letting myself be actually who I am as I'm being it. So there's no idea of censoring or judging, particularly if it's good or bad. Angry thoughts, angry feeling, happy feelings, neutral feelings. The whole realm can just be there. Sometimes when I sit and be with my breath, I have what I call cardboard breath. It's just completely dull and boring and just feels like cardboard, tastes like cardboard, you know. Like it's the most uninteresting thing in the world, you know, the breath. And that has to be okay too, just leave myself alone. And sometimes I have very rich, enlivening breaths. The whole realm of breathing can be there. And leaving myself alone, just letting things be as they are. And by going and turning to the breath, and being with the breath, the kind of life activity of awareness is no longer participating in the constant kind of manipulation of life that can go on, and doing something relatively neutral and often free of that manipulation, that manipulating aspect of consciousness. So leave ourselves alone. And this, of course, allows that manipulating active aspect of the mind to settle down and relax, to unwind. And it's a kind of a learning process then of learning to let self-conscious, let go of self being self-conscious, letting go of anxiety, attachments, things we cling to. And it's phenomenally healing to leave ourselves alone. And it's a whole training and training to learn how to leave ourselves alone. In this light, I'm very fond of the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, kind of the story of I've told it many times, of how the Buddha, you know, tried for 6 years, all kinds of spiritual practices. They were quite willful. First, he did jhanic practices, entering into deep states of concentration, using, in a sense, his will. And then he did ascetic practices for many, many years, very willful practices, kind of putting himself right up against the edge of death by being an ascetic. And finally, despairing that both ways weren't going to help him to become free, he remembered an experience when he was 6 years old, where he was left alone by the other people, the adults. He was left at the edge of the field in the spring when his father was presiding over the spring plowing festival, kind of a ritual for the first plowing of the season. And he was left under the rose apple tree, nice spring day, I imagine, and left alone, and he sat up straight in cross-legged position and entered into a deep state of joy, kind of self-contained joy, kind of like a jhanic joy, and a deep sense of well-being that some children can have that experience of. If you remember back, perhaps some of you can remember back at a time when you were a child, kind of relaxing or settling or spontaneously having experience of deep sense of well-being, and joy or delight or something. And so when he was about 35 or 36 years old, the Buddha remembered this experience when he was six and thought, oh, I've tried all these ways, these willful ways. Maybe I'll try this way. I'll try to leave myself alone and sit up straight with this childlike openness and allow whatever is there to be there and not try to do anything with it, just leave the situation alone. And so the night of his enlightenment, that's what he tried to do. And so this allowing the possibility of this sense of well-being and joy to well up. And symbolically, it's very significant what happened then. And that is, as he left himself alone, Mara came to visit. All the forces, all the demonic forces, all the kind of dark shadow sides of us, perhaps, that have been repressed or held back. You can imagine someone who's doing ascetic practices for 6 years, how much has been held, kind of repressed and held back, denied. And so finally, the lid was pulled, and all the stuff came bubbling up. And it's very hard then to maintain this childlike openness, leaving things alone, when all this kind of stuff comes up. And what I like to say is that Buddha then was able to combine the childlike openness with an adult-like stability. He was committed to not moving. And so that combination of adult stability and childlike openness then was in some ways the key for him then the night of his awakening. So the breath is one of the ways of learning to leave ourselves alone. Just very matter-of-factly, very simply, going back to your breathing, breathing in, breathing out, remembering to be there for the next breath, to breathe in mindfully, breathe out mindfully. To breathe consciously, to breathe mindfully, is very, very powerful. It can seem very boring, it can seem unconnected to any of the other things that you value as being important in your life. But in fact, I would argue that it might be the most important, one of the most important things you can do for yourself is this very simple thing of being with one breath after the other. One breath after the other, leaving yourself alone, letting whatever's there to be there. Don't fight yourself, just very simply, matter-of-factly, letting the breath be the reference point, be the anchor to the present moment. The other way of being with, the other function of the breathing, the second one, is that it's a very powerful way to, it's kind of connected to the first, of cutting through our identifications. We often have very deep perspectives of what life is, views of what life is, views of what we need, what we don't need, what should happen, what shouldn't happen. We have views about who we think we are, who the self is, and the needs of the self, the demands of the self, what the self needs to look like. All these ideas, all these strong identifications. And a lot of the power of how we get caught in our thoughts has to do with this powerful identification we have with ideas of self and needs. And the mind can be on this tremendous track, powerful force of the mind. Probably everybody who meditates probably sooner or later has all too intimately knows how powerful their thinking mind is and the tremendous kind of Velcro that seems to be, you know, there with a thought. Thought arises innocently enough and there's somehow Velcro, right? And, you know, you can't seem to get free of it, you know. They just are magnets. It's like a really powerful magnet, you know. You know, you don't want to be thinking. You think you want to be with the breath. And there you go. And this tremendous kind of momentum and power of attachment, of clinging, of obsession with our thoughts, our identification. And sometimes being with a breath is a very effective way of cutting through that. Where you come back to, every time you come back to the breath, you're letting go of the identification, you're letting go of the little bit of the clinging to those thoughts, to the, seeing the world in that way. And it might seem very insignificant, but with enough times going back to the breath, very quick, relatively to how much time you've had in your life to be attached, very quickly the mind learns to let go and relax that attachment, that identification. And it's really wonderful. It's really great to see life, to see ourselves, to see without the filter of views, without a filter of ideas about what's supposed to be happening. And the breath is one of those places that's very helpful to help to step outside of that momentum in our mind to be stuck in views and perspectives. Just again, it's a matter of coming back matter-of-factly to the breath, breath after breath after breath. There's a line in Dhammapada where the Buddha says something like, drop by drop, the water bucket is filled. Drop by drop, the bathtub is filled. Drop by drop, sooner or later, the pool is filled. Don't overlook the significance of a single drop. With enough drops put together over time, you know, your psyche is filled with the wonderful benefits of concentrating on the breath. So you just come back matter-of-factly to the breath. One moment, one drop of breath. One drop of the breath continuously. The third function of breath meditation is that it provides wisdom, understanding. There's a lot we can understand through attending to the breath because the breath is continuous with the environment around us and it's continuous with the environment within us, the emotional, intentional, volitional life within us. It's people say it's kind of the breath is one of those bridges between the conscious and the unconscious aspects of our lives. We can breathe without thinking about it, and we can intentionally breathe and manipulate our breathing. But as the environment changes, as things happen in the environment, our breath changes also. Sometimes something a little bit frightening happens, and you tighten up the breath. Something very happy happens, and maybe you relax and soften your belly. There's a constant change because the breath provides the energy, I suppose, for the system to operate, helps provide that energy. That there's a constant change and manipulation of breathing going on all the time. And it's fascinating to go about your daily life and to track the changes in your breathing, where in your body you breathe. Are you breathing more in your chest at a particular point, more in your belly, more in your solar plexus area? What's happening? Where are you breathing from? What's happening with your breath? What's happening with the holding patterns connected to your breathing? Drive down the road in your car and come to a red light and check your breathing. How is it at that moment? And is it comfortable? Is it that the way you want to breathe? I notice that how I breathe is affected by how I drive. And sometimes I realize by checking in with my breathing that I don't really want to be driving the way I'm driving because it's just a drag for my body. Oftentimes we don't tune in to our body. We don't tune in to what the cost is of how we're living our lives. And by relaxing a little bit and paying attention to the breath and how it happens in the body, we learn very quickly what the effect our way of living has on our psychophysical system, our body. There's a lot of understanding that can come from there. You know, the word anxiety, I guess in Greek or something, means to choke. Because when you're filled with anxiety, you hold sometimes. You hold something, maybe your neck, your throat. And in this line, there's a lot you can learn about your breathing, from your breathing patterns, about your emotions, your relationship to the world around you. I've noticed that when I work with people one-on-one with their breathing, or when they come and talk to me about what they're learning about their breath and meditation, I've been amazed how deep-seated attitudes about life are manifested in our relationship to our breath. Or how we breathe. And normally we don't notice this stuff because we're not tuned in to this very subtle level often of how we relate to life. And most people, I think, my impression, have some deep fundamental attitude about what it means to be a human being, what it means to be alive, what the world is all about. Some people feel the world is basically a threatening place. It's a view they carry with them all the time. Some people see the world as being a benign place or a friendly place. So all these very deep attitudes. And I've seen it in how people relate to different parts of the cycle of breathing. So we breathe in, we breathe out. There's a beginning of breathing in, there's an end of breathing in. There's a beginning of breathing out, there's an end of breathing out. There's a gap between them. And I find it really fascinating how different points in that cycle can be more active or more charged depending on some attitude that people have. So let me give you an example. Some people feel, occasionally I've met people who find it very hard to be present or let go completely of the out-breath. They start breathing out, and they come, and breathing out, they say, when they tune into it, they feel it's kind of letting go with breathing out. Kind of letting things go, letting the breath go, just letting the muscles go, relaxing. And the idea of letting go for some people is very frightening. Because by holding things together, holding things up, you're kind of protecting yourself, they think. And so the idea of really letting go of the guard, letting go of how we brace ourselves against life, is very deep, very deeply threatening, because life is a very terrifying place, and it's necessary to always be on one's guard. And so it can be very threatening just to really pay careful attention to the end of the out-breath. There are some people who have trouble letting go of the beginning of the out-breath, because they manage to take in all this wonderful things in with the in-breath, and they don't want to let anything go. They want to hold everything to themselves. And so they're reluctant to let go at all. Some people love to let go, because when they let go of all the responsibilities, all the shoulds, and then they just want to linger in letting go, and they want to have a long gap before breathing in. They don't want to breathe in. Because breathing in means you're being assaulted. You know, this whole world is coming to you. You're taking it into your body. And you know, please don't bug my peace. And, you know, just, you know, this great gap. They love it. Some people feel like it's a work to breathe in. They're just tired of always working. Now, this might sound kind of hokey all that to some of you hearing all this, but it's in the very subtle stages of meditation, when the mind gets very quiet and very calm and very attentive, that's when some of these attitudes can get revealed in the breathing. This kind of stuff is invisible often in normal street consciousness where we are. But as we get quieter and quieter, more and more concentrated in meditation, tuning in more, that's when some people find that there are attitudes embedded in their relationship to their breathing. And as we breathe mindfully and committedly, just breathing naturally and continuing to breathe, not letting those relationships, those attitudes get in the way of the breathing, those attitudes with time will learn to relax. I think of the breathing as being the great lubricator. If you just keep breathing consciously and don't let your attitudes about life or attitudes towards anything interfere with your breathing, process, that keeping the breath fluid, keeping it moving, helps minimize the amount of holding that we have. Psychological holding, emotional holding, manifests itself in holding in the body more often than not. But if you keep the breathing fluid, keep it moving, it's very hard to stay held. So like when I'm driving, for example, I notice at the stop sign that I'm holding my breath. I'll relax and continue breathing in a full way. And it's very hard then, as my breath becomes fuller and more relaxed, to continue with the psychological holding attitude that I had, at least for the next 20 feet. So, there's a lot that can be learned from the breathing. Also, it's continuous with the environment. So there's no, when we say in mindfulness practice, we don't make any special effort to breathing in any particular way. There are hundreds and thousands of breathing techniques where you breathe in special ways. In our particular tradition of Vipassana, we don't emphasize breathing in any particular way, but rather just letting the breath be as it is. In the service of developing insight, awareness, and in the service of leaving ourselves alone. Because we think it's very powerful to have some place in your life where you learn to leave yourself alone, where you learn to not manipulate and control things, where you learn to see very deeply what's actually going on there. If you're manipulating your breath, you shortchange the opportunity to see actually your attitudes that are embedded in the way that you breathe. So just breathe in a normal way, whatever it is. Don't worry about how your breath is. Just bring your attention to it, connect to it, explore it, get to know it. As if you're going to get a PhD in breathing. As if it's the most important thing for you to be connected to and to learn from. So even though I say all this about not manipulating or you know, not using a technique with your breathing, I myself find it often very helpful at the beginning of meditation, when I first sit down, to tune in to how I'm breathing, to tune into the places of holding and constriction. And often I find, if I had a busy day, for example, that and I haven't been that mindful of how I've been going about things, that often that there's traces of my attitude, my activity of the day, in how my breathing is. It's being held in certain ways. And so when I first sit down, I try to tune in to that holding pattern of my breathing, how I'm breathing. And if there's any really obvious ways in which I can relax my breathing, expand my breath, fill my body more with my breathing, then I'll do that at the beginning of my sitting, just to let go of that kind of surface tension of the day. And so often I feel my abdomen, my lower, my belly, and I try to relax there. Sometimes it's a band across my chest here. I try to relax and soften there and release the holding that might be there, sometimes in the shoulders. Sometimes I feel it in my nose. There's little muscles in my nose that sometimes get held. And since the breath goes through the nose, it's a place of kind of part of the breathing cycle. And I'll kind of just feel where that is and kind of try to release the bracing, the holding that might be there in the service of letting the breath become more fuller and more relaxed. And then after doing that for a few minutes at the beginning of a sitting, then I'm just with the breath as it is for the most part. Breathing in, breathing out. Hanging in there with the breath. Letting the breath protect you, as Judith Zimmer Brown says. Letting the breath, it's a tremendous protection, the breath. For nothing else, if you're connected to where you're breathing, staying there, you're much more likely to notice what else is going on in your intentions, your desires, your wishes, your fears. The more concentrated, the more still you can get with your breathing, the greater reference point the breath will be for noticing when your mind wants to run off in some other direction. And the more concentrated you are on the breath, the more you notice the subtlety of what's going on in your mind. And subtlety doesn't mean that it's not important. It often means that it's that which is foundational, much more the foundation that builds the whole edifice of how your relationship to the world is. So part of the function of the breath is the stiller you can get with the breath is it highlights all these other things that are going on in your life. You notice more about your life. It's kind of a paradox because often if we're kind of barreling along, lost in our thoughts or preoccupied with our thoughts, our concerns, and our activities, you often don't have the kind of perspective that really lets you see clearly what's going on. And sometimes, by really being with your breath the best you can, don't think of the things that take you away from the breath as being distractions so much, but as things that cause you with the breath, you can actually see more clearly what's the so-called distractions are all about. So just now, you know, just I tuned into my breathing. You know, I was concerned by what I was going to say, and so I was holding my breath. What am I going to say next? I do that a lot when I give these talks, and it's kind of over the many years I give talks, it's one of the things that I've trained myself to do as best I can, is to check into how my breathing is when I talk, or my posture. You know, sometimes I lean forward a little bit when I'm a little bit attached to what I want to say. And so check in with my breath. And often there's kind of upwelling feeling. If I'm a little bit attached or caught by something, not an upwelling feeling, but upwelling tension. You know, I pull the muscles, my torso kind of up. And so when I check in with that, then I can notice that, then let that go and become more centered. So that's my little pep talk. Mostly what I wanted to do this evening is to give a talk that, this morning, is to give a talk that would somehow encourage you to take the breath seriously, more seriously than you have until this morning. Not that some of you haven't taken it seriously. And be inspired to kind of, as you go through the week, this coming week, is to be interested in your breath. Take it more seriously. Don't overlook it. Find as many opportunities as you can to connect to your breathing, whether it's in meditation or outside of meditation. Just make it a theme. Make it as much of a theme as you can. Have right breath, you know, on a whole bunch of little cards, you know, and put it on your mirror in your bathroom when you wake up in the morning, breath, breathe, you know. And then, you know, on your breakfast table, on your steering wheel of your car, and, you know, just do it all kinds of places, you know. Just whatever. Find some way to make breath, you know, the theme of the week. And hopefully this week, I'm going to be very interested in someone else's breath. And my own, I hope, also. And yeah, and the babies. Oh, yeah, when my first kid was born, we brought him home, you know, or even before, we were just there in the hospital, and like, I was constantly checking, is he still breathing? He's still breathing. I couldn't believe it, you know, that he would, you know, he remembered to breathe. Yes.
I have a question. You used a word a couple times earlier. It sounds like janic.
Janic.
And I don't know what that means.
Oh, the word jhana is, in English, I think maybe the best English translation is, there's no good English translation, but probably the best is absorption. To be absorbed in what you're concentrating on. And there's all these psychophysical changes that happens when there's very deep absorption. Like, you know, like if you're absorbed in your book and someone says, hey, you know, you don't hear them because there's a certain kind of change. Or so there's very kind of deep changes that happen. And one important part of Buddhist practice is to cultivate deep states of concentration. These, it's a whole complicated topic in and of itself, but this coming Saturday, Lee Brasington, who's specialized in this area of the jhanas and these absorptions, is going to give a day-long class, giving an overview of these and kind of their historical background and their context and the controversies connected to them. And so that's one way to learn more.
I also wanted to just share something I discovered about breathing. It used to be when I was congested, like when I couldn't breathe, I got in the habit of just breathing in really sharply and holding it and waiting a long time before I breathed again. And it felt like I had to breathe hard in order to get enough air in. And at some point, I finally just relaxed and just sort of trusted myself, I think, to get enough breath in and just breathe very slowly and gently. And, you know, if one of my nostrils was blocked, I wasn't getting as much as I thought I should. But because I was breathing more frequently, I think I was getting enough anyway. But it was sort of a matter of trusting myself. trusting my body to get enough air. You know what I mean? And then it made it easier, like, to get to sleep because I wasn't fighting to get enough air.
That's beautiful. Thank you. I think that the there's a very important connection between breathing and learning to trust deeply. So it's one of the important aspects of cultivating mindfulness of breathing is also, with that comes a kind of deep trust in ourselves and in life. Any questions you would like to ask? We take maybe a couple of 2 minutes or so for questions. Yeah.
What do you think of the part of the book that Tanjeff translated, Keeping the Breath in Mind, where he talks about actually changing the breathing, which of course is very different than we do in Vipassana or mind, if we're being mindful. So I'm wondering if it's just, am I being, is this a mindful sitting, or is this going to be an absorption sitting? Or, and he talks about changing the breath from in short, out long, in long, out long, whatever, you know, different options with that. And so it's more for the purpose of facilitating concentration, I guess, is the purpose of that. But I just wondered what your thoughts were about that.
So Tanjeff is a Buddhist monk that teaches here periodically. And so Jeff's question is, what do I think about his teaching, where actually he emphasizes the importance of manipulating the breath, actually changing the breath and cultivating it, making it more comfortable and breathing in deeply or shallowly and doing various ways of kind of manipulating the breath. And I think it's very powerful to do that and very effective, and it has an important place in practice to do that sometimes. There are many, many different ways of practicing Buddhist meditation, many, many ways of practicing mindfulness. And one way certainly is to manipulate the breath if it helps you get concentrated. And part of the reason he likes to do it is not only to helps with concentration, but it creates a very comfortable, pleasant environment within the physical system. So the breath is much more captivating. His theory is that if your breath is pleasant, your mind will want to stay there. So try to adjust your breathing so it's to maximize the amount of pleasure you get from your breathing. I think it's a fine way of practicing. There's many different ways of practicing Buddhist meditation, and there's different theories about different ways of kind of behind different ways of practicing. He has a particular one. I kind of happy and accept all forms of practice. But the question is not approving or disapproving of practices in the abstract, you know, but rather to look at the specifics of a particular person and what is it most helpful for that particular person at that particular time. And so sometimes what he has to teach is very helpful, and sometimes what he has to teach is not helpful for an individual. Well, that was the 2 minutes. Anyway, so thank you very much.